Rod Bray's attempt to manage the hate crimes debate. Governor Holcomb says no to medical marijuana. That plus Tim Brown and the budget and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending January 4th, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world. Working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, new Senate President Pro Tem Rod Bray says he'll send all of the Senate hate crimes bills to the Rules Committee, though he insists he's not killing those measures. The Rules Committee, at least early in session, is often where bills are sent to die. This particular committee rarely meets until the end of session, where procedural and rule issues mean every conference committee report version of a bill goes there before it heads to the floor. But Senate President Pro Tem Rod Bray specifically notes that's not what he's doing with hate crimes. Bray says every hate crimes bill is in rules until his caucus discusses each proposal and decides which aspects, quote, if any, have enough support among the Senate GOP members. Bray is the chair of the Senate Rules Committee, so his move to assign all hate crimes bills to that committee at the start of session allows him to manage the bills himself. What do we make of Rod Bray's move on hate crimes? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, is this the new Senate leader just trying to manage a thorny issue?
Oh, yeah, he's trying to manage a thorny issue, all right. He's trying to basically punt it. Is what he's trying to do. He's going to take these bills, all of the bills, behind closed doors in their caucus where they control the legislature, and without the benefit of public scrutiny, they're going to carve out something that they can say deals with hate crimes without dealing with hate crimes. They're going to come up and say, well, if you're in a suspect category, a judge could maybe enhance your sentence without defining the suspect category. So we're going to litigate this because the one thing that's clear in the criminal law is you have to know what offense you're committing in order to be guilty of it. And you can't leave something that vague in a statute and still be subject to criminal enforcement. But they're going to punt it because they don't have the wherewithal to stand up and do what's right. I mean, 47 states have this, and Indiana can't do it right.
Yeah, 45 states.
45, excuse me.
Well, 45 states have variations of this.
Yes.
So it's unfair to say, well, Indiana, yes, does not have it, but the list of 16 specific categories do not exist in 45 states. There's
no.
A mixture. There's a mix of
but,
these.
But let
there
me
are
ask
categories.
This.
There are categories.
Yeah. But let me ask this. Why? Because the one state that tried to do one without a category, Georgia, got it struck down because it was too vague or without characteristics. But let me ask this. Why is Rod Bray taking what should be a public process and making it largely a private one?
Well, I don't think he's doing that. There's a good example in this recently of 2016 when the Civil Rights expansion, when they attempted the Civil Rights expansion the year after RFRA. David Long took that bill. Travis Holdman, his majority leader, took that bill up, Senate Bill 100. It was assigned to the Rules Committee. And Senator Long had a hearing. I mean, typically you're correct.
Right.
The Rules Committee traditionally has been a place where you either put bills to die or it meets late in the session to review, from a parliamentary standpoint, what occurred through the process. But not in that case, because I think from a leadership standpoint, Rod Bray has taken control of this so that he can manage the process, so that the senior leaders in the Senate who are on that committee are the ones who are deliberating it in committee. And we'll see where, obviously, the Civil Rights expansion didn't pass, but it was heard, it was heard in a lengthy, day-long hearing.
Oh, I remember.
And ultimately, the votes weren't, they didn't have the votes to pass it. So,
right.
But it wasn't pushed under the rug or put behind closed doors.
Well, I don't know that we didn't have the votes to pass that one, and this is partially the problem.
I was in favor of it and working for it, and we did not
but
have the votes
of
to
the
pass
problem
it.
Is they decide in caucus,
right.
And
right.
If there's not a majority of the majority, they don't bring it up for a vote. So, I mean, right. Do I think there are 26 votes for a hate crimes
sometimes,
bill in
the
Senate?
Sometimes that's true. It's not always true.
Yeah, on the on the civil protections one you were talking about. That's what I was talking about. And so are there 26 votes for that? Probably. But they don't even want to consider Democrat votes. And I just don't understand why it needs to be treated like something so different. Like, why does it have to go to a special committee? And why don't we just, like, let it go through the process like other bills?
Because they're afraid of their primary contenders. That's what they're afraid of. They're afraid of an attack from the right wing of the Republican Party, and that's what this is all about.
And this is not happening in a vacuum. People still remember, at least those lawmakers who've been around for a few years, remember 2015, and are still stinging in some cases from the debate over the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and the black eye that many thought that Indiana received nationally from would-be employers who might move to the state, or employers already here that said they were having trouble recruiting. So I think that this all feeds an attempt to, and I'm not saying it's what you see read in the civic lessons in the books back in high school about how government works.
None of it has ever been.
Never has been.
What you read about it,
I learned that early on, too. But I think it is an attempt by leadership, by Rod Bray, to manage and create the storyline because, and I'll refer back to 2015 again, if, in fact, you know, there's a debate over what's going to preserve the integrity or the reputation of the state nationally, it may be that, you know, when this explodes, as it probably inevitably will in some fashion, that debate over which of the five, six characteristics, and it might be that the committee level proceedings over whether to include gender identification or not and leaving it out could have actually perhaps a more negative effect than not addressing the issue at all.
Let me ask each of you this, because Governor Holcomb has been is going to be very out front on this. He said this year he's going to lead. He wants to lead the way to get a hate crimes bill. Does he have the ability to push something like this through?
I think he does, and I think he's shown so far that he's been willing to be upfront and open about it. Everywhere he goes, no matter what part of the state is in or what kind of audience it is, whether it's a room full of Republicans in rural Indiana or a room full of business leaders in Indianapolis, he's been very clear that this is on his agenda, that he wants this done. He's been clear publicly and behind closed doors with legislators if that's the case.
How big a test is this for Eric?
Oh, I think it's a big test. And if he comes up with the vague kind of nonsense that says we've checked that box, we've done what we should do, and doesn't provide real protections for those suspect classes, then shame on him, because he's got the supermajorities in both houses. And if he really is going to push a bill, even in front of Republican audiences, that gives the right kinds of protections to the full spectrum, then he should be able to get it done. And if he doesn't, it's a big failure on his part.
It's instructive politically that David Long and Travis Holden during those civil rights debates did attract a primary opponent and beat them both by 40 or 50 points.
I mean,
so there's no political evidence
that
this is a consequence.
That doesn't mean they have the courage to take one on.
Eric Holcomb hasn't had a lot of experience so far as governor in pushing through, in coming out on controversial issues. Most of the stuff he's tackled has been stuff that a lot of people support. So what do you expect to see out of him now that he's tackling a more controversial?
I don't know. I mean, he has been very open. If you ask him, he says we need to get off the, quote, naughty list. You know, I do think there is a difference between just saying I support something and, you know, is he going to hold a press conference and stand up there with LGBT Hoosiers who are the victims of similar crimes? I mean, that would be really proactively pushing something. So we, you know, time will tell how much he pushes it.
Yeah, is he going to sit down with legislators, bring them into the office and say, I want your vote?
He already is doing
that. He is starting to do that.
So is he going
to
line them up?
Line them up.
Is he going to simply say, you know, you either go my way or
he lets them sit wherever they want. They can sit wherever they want. They don't have to line up.
I think he might say that he's already has skin in the game in that he made it one of the five pillars or one of his legislative planks, you might say, of his platform. I think what one will really know for sure is on the 15th of this month when the State of the State is delivered, because we'll know instantly.
I expect it'll be there. The question maybe of how prominent. Yeah.
And I think the way it's framed.
I think
I know how it's going to be framed, and it's the five pillars. We have probably someone
will
who helped write the five.
Talking about the five pillars?
Oh, I know. That's
nobody.
To, okay.
Even for inside baseball,
all right,
nobody
but
knows.
But this is the attempt to take it to the next level. Let's put it that
there
way.
There you go.
Like all of this.
If you look at the theme of those planks, those promises, those agenda items, it's all about quality of life in Indiana with an eye toward creating an atmosphere that's conducive to job growth and workforce development. And I think that's how this issue will clearly be framed. And that's what gives him, I think, a certain degree of political cover on with it conservatives within the party.
Depends on how it's defined.
Yeah, sure it is.
I mean, if it's open and vague, he can say, well, he's created the climate.
He's already staked out his position, though.
Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, will the legislature pass a hate crimes bill in the 2019 session? A yes or B, no. Last week's question, which was actually from a couple weeks ago, will South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg run for president in 2020? 33% say yes, 67% say no, he won't. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Governor Eric Holcomb says he remains firmly opposed to any effort by state lawmakers to legalize marijuana for any purpose. Holcomb has long been opposed to any sort of marijuana legalization, but Indiana is now in the minority in the country for states that have taken some steps to legalize the drug, whether for medical or recreational purposes. Still, Holcomb remains steadfast. He insists there needs to be more research on its potential medicinal benefits, and the governor points to the federal government, saying he'd like to see it act to sanction the drug before Indiana dives in. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle will push for medical marijuana legalization in 2019 with the backing of groups that include veterans organizations. But law enforcement and the Indiana Chamber of Commerce oppose such a move.
Mike O'Brien, how long, quite frankly, can leaders forestall medical marijuana legalization here?
It's gotten more traction every year in the legislature. I think the governor's point, he's not some prude on this, right? I mean, his point is the right one, which is it's still a Schedule I narcotic, which by definition says it has no medicinal value. So the feds do need to act, and frankly, I don't know why it's not a no-brainer to just take it off the Schedule I list, let the FDA start looking at this. The majority of Americans live in states or in jurisdictions that where this is legal for one vast majority now after November, who live in a jurisdiction that legalizes this for
in some form.
Yeah, it's legal in some form, so I don't know why they don't go down this road and just let the states once and for all kind of legally figure this out. The governor's right. Look, this is still, it's the strangest scheme that this is still illegal. It's still something that is a cash business, that is a cash drug trade business.
Yeah, if we're talking about
it has to be because it's illegal. It's still federally illegal.
If we're talking about
taking
sports wagering out of the black market into the legal market.
Yeah. And we've already taken marijuana, and
right.
It's in the light, and it's really mainstream.
Right.
Which might help. I mean, it might help some people with chronic illnesses and that get no relief any other way. And, you know, I think it's a no-brainer, too, and he ought to just ante up and say, look, if it still has to be prescribed if it's medical marijuana. So some doctor has to determine that whoever it is that patient is treating needs this substance in order to get relief. It's not up to the legislature. And it's not, you know, so I think he ought to just back off that. And frankly, you know, it's kind of the mirror image of the hate crimes issue. Okay, if he can't push the hate crimes through in a good fashion, can he stop marijuana from coming through on the other side?
I think that might be a little easier. What do you expect from medical marijuana this session, at least?
I mean, we might have a hearing to have some basic debate, but I don't expect it'll move. And you know, I do wonder at some point, we have 33 states now with medical marijuana.
Something like that,
I mean,
yeah.
At some point there should be some, you know, scientific medical evidence on this helping. But all I ever hear is, you know, my Aunt Helen has a back problem
well,
and she takes it.
Well, it's the same thing.
Right,
with
but we have 33 states who are doing it, who are
right.
issuing
right.
that. So
but
why?
But the regulator who decides that is the FDA. And it's so the feds have got to get it out of the way.
Well,
they've got to
stop. Here's the question:
stop interfering with the testing as to whether or not it's good. It's the same thing with they're not allowed to come up with statistics on guns and gun violence for the same reason.
There's a specific ban on that.
Some states are allowing testing. Pennsylvania, for instance.
Well, I mean,
let me ask this. Because Holcomb's line on the feds need to deal with this first is he's not the only one saying that. So, in your mind, what happens first? The feds take some steps to loosen the hold on marijuana, or Indiana just jumps in?
Well, there's not a lot of room, it seems to me, wiggle room in what Eric Holcomb has said. This is not a position. Sometimes you'll see Eric Holcomb or anybody in that position say, well, this is an important issue, strong feelings on both sides, merits on both sides, we're going to study it. He didn't say that. He said, basically, I wasn't in the room, but what I read was, this will not happen until the federal government removes the ban. So that's pretty clear. There's not a lot of wiggle room. So I guess the question is, how long is he governor versus what will the federal government do? But I
Michael
think,
Bryan, what do you think?
But keep in mind, it's if you had we just talked about hate crimes or bias crimes legislation. If he were out front now on legalization of marijuana, I mean, he does still He has an R behind his name, but I mean,
to be out front.
And I know it's not necessarily an R or D issue, but one other point. Last year when there was confusion over cannabis oil and there were conflicting opinions about what had been enacted and so forth, just I don't think he's been, you know, necessarily an ideologue on this position, because did he not say we need to resolve it in favor of cannabis oil?
He did come out. So I mean, it's not as if
he's like, anything with a, with that many
no, I mean,
leaves
is bad. He's just saying we can't legalize something that's federally illegal. Yeah.
Well, it's close to the Buckeye, though.
I can't tell.
All right, well, 2019 is a budget writing session for the General Assembly, and this year's budget process will feature several new faces. Ways and Means Chair Tim Brown has been the House GOP's budget architect since 2013, but he's still on the mend in 2019 following a serious motorcycle crash last year. In response, Speaker Brian Bosma asked Representative Todd Houston to take a new role, co-chair of Ways and Means, helping lead the House version of a new two-year state budget. Houston says he'll draw on lessons he's learned over the years from Brown.
Bringing the entire caucus together, kind of walk them along what the challenges are, what the opportunities are, and I don't think there'll be a tremendous amount of change, but I'm sure we all have different personalities.
Houston isn't the only new face around the budget writing table this year. This will be the first budget for Ryan Mishler as chair of Senate Appropriations and the first for Travis Holdman as Senate Tax and Fiscal Policy Chair. It will also be the first budget for new Senate President Pro Tem Rod Bray. Nikki Kelly, how do all of these new players affect the budget process?
I think it's kind of the sleeper issue of the session because, you know, I mean, there's no institutional knowledge anymore on program funding or, you know, when we talk about, you know, reversions and, you know, executive power and what level of the surplus, I mean, all of that stuff is going to come to a head. And I think it puts the administration, frankly, through Governor Holcomb's office, kind of in the lead as far as being able to guide the budget process.
Yeah, without, I mean, Doc Brown will definitely be around, but without him, Micah Vincent is one of the most seasoned budget writers in the State House right now. How do you think it affects the process?
Well, I would agree. Obviously, Indiana is not a state with legislative term limits. There are others that do, and I think when you look at those states, one of the things that is fairly common, you don't have this deep-seated expertise where you've crafted budgets, or it could be any topic from telecommunications to criminal justice reform. And when that happens, when you have term limits, when people, it's more of a revolving door, you tend to put more of an emphasis or more power in the hands of staff and of lobbyists. And I don't mean that necessarily in a bad way, but probably you could argue there's nobody with greater expertise on a lot of the very complicated issues that the lawmakers deal with these days than lobbyists. And I think at least there will be a role for them, and it's going to be interesting to watch.
Should we have any worries about this being a slightly rockier process because of so many new people involved?
The rockiness is going to be in the limited amount of discretionary spending that they have to deal with and what are the priorities going to be and how do legislators who are asking for things, how does all play out, and how do they leverage it off other issues? The comments before have been correct. The staff at OMB, Micah Vincent, Jason Dudich for the administration, Ben Tooley and Matt Butler for the House Republicans and David Reynolds, these guys have worked together for a long time now, and they've been through several budgets together. So there is some continuity there and some awareness of what the issues are, what the program funding should be.
Given the discussion already around the budget and how tight it might be, does it actually make it easier because it's really easy to just say no?
Say no a lot.
It's really programmatic, okay? All we do in this state is cut corporate taxes, and when we cut the corporate taxes, we were supposed to be inundated with jobs and rising incomes
and revenue coming in.
Corporate taxes almost don't exist anymore. Okay? They almost don't exist anymore. And then we don't have any money. So we can't invest in infrastructure. We can't invest in people. We can't do any of the things that would make this state greater. Because we're not interested in doing that. We're interested in cutting taxes for corporations, maintaining a surplus, and protecting those who already have everything they need. And that's the sad part of this. With a little initiative here, we could actually do some pretty meaningful things like, heaven forbid, preschool education for every child in the state. Oh, no. We have to take it incrementally, almost one child at a time, because we don't have the guts to do what needs to be done.
It's not the revenue's down. revenue is up.
It's not corporate revenue, not the way it was supposed to be.
If the base number is going up,
because it could go up a hell of a lot more if they were being taxed the right way.
I mean, there's no denying that if we weren't cutting corporate taxes, we would have money to do the things we need to do,
and we won't do it. Even though we cut corporate taxes on the QT, $180 million more on your special session last time around. You did do it on the QT.
All right. Well, the federal government has been shut down for going on 2 weeks, with President Trump now having to negotiate an end to the stalemate with a Democrat-controlled House.
The budget impasse stems primarily over funding for President Trump's proposed wall on the southern border. Democrats have supported some money for border security, but have said no to specific funding for a wall. Trump initially said he would, quote, own a shutdown, though he's since sought to shift blame for the stalemate onto Democrats. Several Indiana congresspeople urged an end to the shutdown, though statements from GOP members stressed the need for border security, while Indiana Democrats focus on the economic impact of the shutdown.
John Schwanes, with Democrats now in control of the U.S. House, is there hope for this stalemate to end anytime soon?
Well, if you charted my hope for a resolution, it probably would look like the Dow Jones Industrial Average, you know, up and down each day. And I say that because you look at, there were signs at times this past week where there may have been, shall we say, a glimmer of hope. Again, this is all in the eye of the beholder, I suppose. But you had Cory Gardner, senator, Republican senator from Colorado. You had Susan Collins, Republican senator from Maine, who were the first, you might say, defectors who wanted to see votes on the two bills
that came over from the House,
which said at least let's get some temporary funding in place. I think, though, the other glimmer of hope, again, some would say this is a bad thing, but you looked at what the market was doing early in midweek, and more than any other president probably in memory, it seems that Donald Trump uses the stock market as an indicator of his success, whether that's warranted or not, and I think economists would say not. But there was a lot of concern about not only trade issues with China, but also the uncertainties in Washington. So I think when you were seeing these 200, 300, 500, 600 point drops earlier in the week, that might have been an impetus for him to do it. Then the new job numbers come out and then everything spikes. And so now I think my optimism for a resolution is not as sound.
In terms of impact, do you think the average American notices?
I do think that's interesting. I think because it happened over the holidays, maybe we didn't hear as much about, you know, the people who are impacted, the 800,000 furloughed federal workers. I mean, there's no panda cam from the National Zoo, guys. This is serious. But honestly, I don't know whether to think it's interesting that we're not noticing that the federal government isn't working, or
troubling.
Yeah.
How does this process play out, though, when with such an unpredictable president?
I don't have any idea. I mean, you would think that they could work out something, and instead he sends Pence to the Hill and has him cut a deal and then rejects it. I mean, talk about a slap in the face. And if you're on the Democratic side of that and you're trying to negotiate, with whom do you negotiate? I mean, you would think that the vice president making an offer like that and then being able to work on that would be the White House, and it turns out it isn't.
Yeah, we're still.
I don't know what they're going to do. I don't know how they're going to resolve it. I think the impact is going to be felt more gradually as people apply for passports or do other things where they interact
tax
with
returns,
tax returns, things like that.
So, with Democrats now in control of the House, in your mind, does that make the prospect of a deal more or less likely, or does it not really matter?
Well, it certainly makes it less likely that it would happen in the time frame that would have happened if Republicans were still in control of the House, but. The wall is the sticking point, clearly, yeah. Right?
That we know.
It's incredible that, and it will be interesting to see over time if we're here talking about this in a week or two. It's become such a proxy for a successful immigration policy. And it's a pretty low price tag in a legislative environment for leverage. If they ultimately, and I don't know if politically Democrats can ever bring themselves to agree to it, but if they ever can, they can probably get a lot for it in terms of what they get back, whether it's DACA protections
it's
or Dreamers.
$5 billion. I know
that's a drop in the bucket, but that's five billion dollars. That's like saying that's a half a billion dollars we're dealing with.
All right, let's moving on. The Indiana General Assembly, as we talked about, began its 2019 session this week. So it is time, as we wrap up, for some predictions from our panelists. So when we're on this show in nearly 5 months, God willing, looking back at the 2019 session,
What will have been the dominant theme of this year? I'll start with you, Ann Delaney.
No guts, no glory. I mean, they won't do anything meaningful. They won't stop cutting the corporate tax breaks that they've scheduled over the 10 years. They won't invest in education. They won't invest meaningfully in infrastructure. They'll do what little has to be done so that they can say they did something.
I'm guessing you have a different answer.
Well, if they raise corporate income taxes, that will be the biggest story on the session for
a
Republican-run
legislature.
I think that one of the biggest stories, I think, is going to be more from a process standpoint. We're going to have 22 new members, and I don't think they're going to sit around and kind of wait to be asked to do something. I think we're going
to
see some assertive and some emerging leaders.
Very quickly, John.
I don't know how much of it we'll see, but behind the scenes, gaming-related legislation will be a dominating fact. The money is just too significant and too much is at stake. So we will see. It may emerge in a way we saw back in 1993 when it wasn't an issue until the end of the session and it was tied into budget considerations.
Very quickly.
Follow the money. It's all about the budget.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the new WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.